Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. But I'll tell you, I had a near-death experience.
A near-death experience.
Not my death. It was a death near to me. It was actually a very strange thing. I went to a restaurant called Fiamma. Fabio Trabocchi's restaurant. Fabio has been on our show. He was a chef at Maestro down in Washington.
Well, he was a chef, yeah. He wasn't his restaurant. He was a chef.
Right, chef down there. But he came up with great fanfare to be the chef at Fiamma restaurant in New York. 3-star New York Times, and I heard great things about the restaurant. I knew the wine director there. I was at the ballet a couple of weeks ago, and afterwards we decided to go grab a bite, and I've been trying to get to Fiamma since Fabio's been up. So we went to dinner, called up our mutual friend Eric Zillier, who is the wine director up at Alto, and said, hey, you're getting off early, let's go and have dinner. So the three of us had dinner. My friend Eric Zillier and I both knew the sommelier there. I knew the chef just from being on the show. He's not like Fabio Trabocchi, he's a friend. And we had a great time at the bar. It was very elegant. We had.
I had heard only great things about the restaurant.
Maybe a 10 o'clock reservation on a Tuesday night, and we had three courses. We didn't say for a big long menu, but they sent us a course because they knew us, so it was really 4 courses. Just lovely, great wine selections, good cocktail at the bar, really good cocktail at the bar, beautiful restaurant, and the staff cooked their heart out, and they...
Everything done right.
Everything was perfect, and it turns out we were the last ones there, because we had a late reservation. It was a weeknight, it was 9:30.
We're always the last ones there, Francis. That's welcome to our lives, by the way.
So
Francis and I, if we come to your restaurant, we're going to be the last ones there.
But we will order well and tip well. So we were the last ones in, which wasn't unusual because we were there until midnight, 12:30 on a, you know, and this wasn't a happening bar kind of restaurant. It's an elegant 3-star restaurant. And it was a weeknight. It was cold outside. So we stepped outside. We said our goodbyes at the host. The sommelier walked us to the door. We got our coats. We walked into the winter night. Eric went uptown to his home, and my friend Chris and I got back in a car and came back to Jersey. And at 9 o'clock the next morning, I got a text message from my friend Eric. It had Fiamma closed. We were the last customers ever in Fiamma. Okay, Fiamma's 3-star New York Times restaurant.
It is a world. The world is changing. Because at this point, good restaurants. Always restaurants have closed. Right. Always, there's always been openings and closings of restaurants, and that's
just part
of the world that Francis and I live in. And maybe it's because a chef moves on and does something else. Maybe it's because poor management, maybe it's because it's not run right, maybe it's because it's in a bad location. None of these things are true of Fiamma.
Now, it was on Sullivan Street in the corner of Spring in the heart of Soho in a perfect district if you wanted to drive in or mass transit in, and it was quite busy. When Fabio Trabocchi was actually interviewed in the New York Times food section that appeared the very next day. So obviously Fabio knew that it was going to close. And he said something about being down about 25% through the holidays. And with the way things are in New York, you know, they can't afford being 25%.
Can't be down 25%.
You know, your rents are still very, very high.
So the fixed costs are too high to lose 25% of your business. You know, the same day Fiamma closed, a restaurant in Brooklyn that was one of the pioneer restaurants in Brooklyn called Patois closed. Alan Harding was the chef, and when he opened, that's got to be about 10 years ago in Brooklyn.
At least.
Maybe 12 years ago. Lots of fanfare, lots of great chefs and restaurant people in New York City talking about how the contemporary restaurant scene was expanding to Brooklyn. And so what a surprise to see those two restaurants close in the same week.
Yeah,
there's a new world order.
I
think that we hang on and try and get to the other side.
Well, you know, the thing is, though, it's with any economic, people still got to eat, right? And I'm glad we have a liquor license because people still want to go to bars, right. And have a good time. And the thing is, look, if you're in the restaurant business and you're a place where you can make it, you just have to be the best that you can do. Mm-hmm. I think it's easier for restaurants that own their own building. I think it's easier for restaurants that have been there for a long time. I mean,
absolutely.
After 17 years, our roots run deep in the community. That's great.
We've talked about that before, how I wouldn't want to be the brand new restaurant right now. I just think that's too hard.
But I have to tell you, Fiamma is going to be missed. And to the folks that work at Fiamma, to mm-hmm. Fabio, to the waiters and the sommelier, I don't know if the waiters and the sommelier and knew what was happening, but they cook their hearts out mm-hmm. to the very end.
To the very last meal.
And I promise you, to the very last morsel of dessert. And their service was impeccable and gracious until the end. And, you know, my hat's off to the staff of that restaurant.
One of the things Fabio said in the Times as well was, listen, I'm not the last guy this is going to happen to in this, and I think unfortunately that's true. And you're seeing every week in the Times there's what restaurants closed. And yes, there's openings, but I think the closings is going to outpace the openings for a little while.
So if you have a favorite place that you like to go to and you'd like to see remain here, go out and eat in it. You know, if you have a favorite place that's a part of your neighborhood, that's a part of your community, that when we come out on the other side of this, you would be really sad if it's not around, go out and eat in it. And, you know, if you go out once a week, pick that place that's really important to you, because not everybody's going to be around a year from now. And keep the faith, everybody. We'll get through this together. So we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Our guest today is the esteemed chef David Waltuck. He has written with Andrew Friedman a book with his title the same as his fine restaurant in New York City. It's entitled Chanterelle, The Story and Recipes of a Restaurant Classic.
David, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, we haven't really met before. Actually, we did meet in passing many years ago, just as you were walking by somewhere. But so you may not know this, but Mark and I are huge fans of your restaurant. We've been there, I don't know, a dozen times, and you do amazing work there.
Thank you.
And now you've written a book. Is this your first cookbook? We know you did Family Meals.
Yeah, we did. I did a staff, what I called Family Meals, the staff meal cookbook, in 2000.
And people should know that what family meal or what staff meal, that's in most fine dining restaurants, ours included, when at the beginning of service the whole staff sits together and we have dinner together, just like a family, mm-hmm. and feeding and nourishing people. Basically, there are two schools of thought on family meals, and I worked in a restaurant once where, you know, basically they served us this family meal, but it wound up being inedible, and, you know, you'd rather go out and get a slice of pizza. And what we've done and what you do at Chanterelle, you're famous for serving people a good and nutritious meal while you get together for your pre-service meeting. And you wrote a book about the family meals that you served over time with.
That's right. I'd been toying with the idea of doing a book, and I wasn't at that point. I didn't feel ready to do the book. It just felt like a little too heavy at that point. And mm-hmm. so I thought the more lighthearted thing to do first would be the staff meals book. It turned out to be just as much work as any other book, probably more, because it was the first one. But it's a nice book, and I get great feedback still from people. I mean, a lot of people really, really use it.
We've used it in the restaurant. When one of our chefs years ago was sort of running out of ideas and had gotten into a rut of preparing the same thing over and over again, we gave him the book and said, cook stuff out of here.
And to this day, David, you should know that we have a large library for the restaurant, but in the bookshelf that sits behind our desk, there are 20 or 30 books, and Staff Meals is one of the books that sits on that shelf behind our desk.
Oh, thank you.
But now we have the Chanterelle cookbook. This is we actually now get to see the food that you serve the customers, so we should assume an upgrade in here. Why now? Why are you ready now for the Chanterelle cookbook?
Well, I've been doing this for nearly 30 years now, and I don't know, I guess writing a book may be a little bit like having a baby. You know, you forget about the pain after a while, and then you want to do another one. And that's sort of what happened to me. I felt like, okay, now's the time. And I couldn't tell you exactly why. Maybe the approach of the 30th, where we're now in our 30th year. I think also the fact that I felt like all the people were sort of in place.
Mm-hmm.
I was very, very happy with my co-author, Andrew. And publisher just seemed, everything just seemed bright. And I think everybody did a great job. I'm very, very happy and very proud of the book.
Well, your style is really uniquely your own, and you've been considered one of the best chefs in New York, ergo one of the best chefs in the country, like you said, for 30 years now. You started, what, in 79, was it you opened Chanterelle?
Yeah, November 79.
Well, that's it. That's the kind of the birth of the contemporary American restaurant scene in New York, isn't it?
Well, I would say so. I mean, it was a very, very different world, restaurant-wise and food-wise, in those days. It was pre a lot of things that people sort of take for granted now.
Like what?
Things like the availability of lots of ingredients, mm-hmm. wild mushrooms, foie gras, lots of different kinds of game, you know, heirloom breeds of pork, and so on. It was before the Food Network. It was before, you know, all the intense hype that accompanies the world of being a chef nowadays, at least for some people.
Hmm.
You know, when I went to college, I was going to be a scientist, and nobody in my family had any connection with the restaurant business, and nor did we know anyone that had any connection with the restaurant business, and it was just a passion of mine. And when my parents thought I was crazy when I told them I wanted to go to culinary school. I mean, they supported me, but they were not at all convinced that it was a reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, Francis and my parents were not exactly pleased at our choice of vocation either.
Well, it was a very different era. You know, it's funny, though, you talk about how the world has changed. And your restaurant had a very great effect on us. Our restaurant's been around for 17 years now.
Mm-hmm.
But shortly after we opened, so it was 1992, a good friend of mine, a woman named Tracy Dutton, whom I don't know if you know or not, brought me to lunch at your restaurant, and I'd never been. And the cheese cart came over. The cheese course was presented after lunch, which I'd never seen in an American restaurant before. And I was so inspired, and I came back, and I grabbed Mark, and we went to lunch shortly thereafter, and I said, you know, we have to do this in New Jersey. Well, little did we know how difficult it was to procure really great cheese back then, 93, 94. Now there are several purveyors.
Much easier job now.
Where you can, you know, order it and it gets delivered or FedExed or UPS to you overnight. But, you know, back then we were buying cheese. We struck a deal where we would buy wholesale from Dean and DeLuca or Murray's Cheese and we'd drive into New York ourselves and pick it up.
Uh-huh.
That was a tremendous thing that you did back then.
Well, it was easier for us, I think, because we were originally in Soho.
Mm-hmm.
And Dean and DeLuca was a few blocks away, and they were kind of really just starting. Giorgio DeLuca had a little place called the Cheese Store on Prince Street when I was in high school. And then he joined forces with Joel Dean and opened up the first Dean and DeLuca, which was just across the street on Spring Street, and you know, went on from there. But that was the store that we went to when we wanted to buy cheese, and we just bought cheese on a pretty much almost daily basis.
But that was sort of an unprecedented thing back when you started doing that. Well, what prompted you to, I mean, it was sort of de rigueur in European restaurants, but were you guys the first in New York to take a cheese course seriously?
I think we might be. I can't swear to it, but, you know, I was very influenced by the idea of what a three-star restaurant in France was like in those days. It's probably, I think gradually over the years, sort of the ante has been upped in the States and also probably in Europe as well. As to, you know, sort of luxury that accompanies a fancy meal. But we were a pretty simple place when we first opened. We were a 30-seat restaurant on Grand Street with a little tiny kitchen and not much space. But what we wanted to do, and I don't know if I could have articulated it then, but I would say what we wanted to do was just to do an American version of what we felt was the best of the great restaurants that we had eaten in France.
And how did, besides, you know, sourcing cheeses locally and incorporating that into the American restaurant experience, how did you make the restaurant uniquely American?
Well, it wasn't a plan, but I think it happened. And I think it happened because I think my style, while it's, you know, my first sort of interest in food was in French cooking. And I think anybody that started cooking that was really passionate about cooking in the 70s, they probably would have come through the world of French food because that was it was
they were the leader.
Kind of systematic. There was, you know, there was that was what luxury was in terms of dining, and you know, it was a really good framework and still is a really good framework for learning how to cook. But what I cook and the way I cook, the style I cook, I think is American in that aside from ingredients and so on. there's kind of an intensity of directness of flavor. I kind of like the flavors to really, you know, come out and grab you. French cooking tends to be more subtle in a way. I mean, maybe subtle is not the right word, but a little more delicate in a lot of ways. Like if I do a canal or something like that, I mean, I do sort of some of these old school things that not very many people do anymore. But the flavors that accompany it are pronounced and powerful. It's not soothing in the same way that you might think of a canal.
Your restaurant's now 30 years old, or just about 30 years old. What has changed as far as what the customers get? Now, we know that the customers have changed. We know that the landscape has changed. But how have you changed and evolved your restaurant over the last 30 years from 1979 to today? Now I didn't come to your restaurant till 92. You were already 13, 14 years old. You had already moved to Tribeca. Tell me about the evolution. I mean, my restaurant today is very different than it was 17 years ago, and I would expect that for most restaurants that's the case.
Well, it's changed, but it's still very much true to what we started out trying to do. I don't think that the style of cooking has changed. I think that over the years there's been more of a kind of opening up to different ingredients from different cuisines, like Chinese, Japanese, Middle Eastern, and so on and so forth. But they're all still filtered and used through the sort of the same aesthetic and technique. I would say that one of the things that's changed is just when I say, you know, the ante gets upped, I mean, what happens is, you know, we didn't serve a mise en bouche when we first opened, and then we started to, and then we decided that we had to do petit fours at the end, and then we decided we had to do petit fours and chocolates, and then we decided that one amuse-bouche wasn't enough, we should do two. And we've improved, you know, the quality of the china and the glassware and the silverware and all of that, and kind of refined the service maybe a little bit. But still, all in all, I don't think that in any way the experience of coming to Chanterelle today is really, really different from what it was in 79. It's just kind of expanded and improved, I hope.
And that's kind of the point I wanted to get to. If you think today about how many restaurants there are that are the same, and I don't want to say you're the same, because clearly you've improved in places you can improve, but philosophically the same restaurant as they were 30 years ago, to count those number of restaurants...
How many restaurants are even still open?
First of all, how many are still open?
It changed.
And then to count the number of restaurants that are philosophically the same, I just have to think that had to do not just with having a great idea that has lasted the test of time, but being forward-thinking for the time you were in.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think that we were among the first to do a number of things that are now kind of taken for granted. The cheese course is just one part of it, but you know, French restaurants in the late 70s in New York were pretty much, there were the bistros, mm-hmm. and then there were the fancy restaurants. And the fancy restaurants were all very much in the old school French tradition. And they were run by French people, and there were French people in the kitchen. And they served kind of classic food. And this was sort of the beginning of Nouvelle Cuisine, which is kind of become, you know, the punchline of a joke at this point to some degree, but it really shouldn't be, because, you know, what everybody cooks nowadays is Nouvelle Cuisine, even if they don't realize it. You know, every restaurant that has any sort of aspiration to doing something good, special, they're trying to find a style of their own. The chef is cooking, you know, is working with his own dishes, making up his own dishes, his own variations on classics and so on. You know, the idea of freshness, of seasonality, the way food is presented on a plate, in a kind of, you know, my plating is not super elaborate, but it's thought out, and it's, you know, it's intended to look good. I mean, all of that is what pretty much everybody in any style of cooking does nowadays, but that was surprising then. That was what they call Nouvelle Cuisine.
Well, and if you look back at the history, I mean, I think it's really, I just find culinary history and restaurant history to be fascinating. You were granted early accolades by Gail Green, who was at the height of her powers at the time as the restaurant critic at New York Magazine. But also the New York Times back then, pretty much they didn't review restaurants unless they were French for the most part, and they didn't really review in the serious column restaurants below 14th Street. And you got them to come way downtown, and, you know, you got 3 stars, was it, at first from?
We had 2 stars at first, uh-huh, actually, from Mimi Sheridan. We've been reviewed by the New York Times, I can't even tell you, maybe 9 times.
But back in the early days, it was a real break for them to come so far downtown and review an American restaurant seriously. Wasn't it?
Absolutely. There were. I always sort of come back to this. There were 3 restaurants that opened right around the same time in New York that were, we were sort of lumped together as I don't know, kind of a thought of as one sort of group. There was the Quilted Giraffe. There was Chanterelle, and there was a place called Dodin Bouffant, which not that many people remember anymore. But the thing that we all shared, one of the things we all shared, was that we were all American. There were all couples that had opened the restaurants. We were all American. None of us were French trained. And we were trying to do, you know, for want of a better phrase, we were trying to do our own thing. And the end of the story I always tell is that, you know, 30 years on, of the 3 restaurants and the 3 couples, we're the only ones that are still in business and still married.
My wife comments all the time that how the fact that we're married, have 4 kids, and happily married 17 years into this, she keeps asking me for another example of who might be married for a long time in the restaurant business and happily.
I'm happy to serve as your example.
Thank you for being there for us.
If Mark, if we had been married, we'd be divorced by now. For sure. The business would still be there, but we'd be divorced by now. Hey, listen, we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk more with David Waltuck about his restaurant, and we'll talk more in the coming segment, I promise, about his book, Chanterelle, The Story and Recipes of a Restaurant Classic. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com. I would like to announce the most exciting new project Mark and I have launched in years. We've teamed up with some old friends, Mike and Jennifer Schnur, and worked with our chefs and purveyors of artisanal food products to create RestaurantGuysChocolate.com. Yeah, baby, we've created a line of extraordinary and delicious chocolates in a palette of thoughtful and complex flavors. They're sexy, they come in a great, beautiful red box, they're handmade, and they make a perfect gift or a perfect personal indulgence. We ship overnight, or you can pick them up at the restaurants. The website is RestaurantGuysChocolate.com, or find the link at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. We put our heart and soul into every box, and each one's made by hand. There's a little bit of my soul in every piece of candy, that's right, and a little bit of Mark's too. So check out RestaurantGuysChocolate.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking today with David Waltuck. He is the chef owner of Chanterelle. His new book is Chanterelle. It's easy to keep track of it that way. You can find out more about it and even order it through RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
David, one of the hallmarks of Chanterelle, as I see it, has been its impeccable consistency. Now, again, we talked earlier in the show, I've only been going to the restaurant for the last 17 years, but I've probably been there 10, 11, 12 times, somewhere in that area, and it has been impeccably consistent over those years. Yet, I've seen your stars in the New York Times go 4, 3, 3, 4, kind of bounce around. How does that affect you when you're fairly certain that the restaurant's been consistent and the reviews aren't as consistent?
Well, you know, reviews are tough. I've grown sort of a thicker skin over so many years, but I remember being intensely affected by them in the beginning.
Yeah, my skin could use a little thickening, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, beyond leaving aside the whole issue of how it affects your business, which is an enormously important thing, you know, it's a very public, and people tend to take certainly the New York Times review and certain other reviews as authoritative, so that, you know, you become a 3-star restaurant all of a sudden, mm-hmm, where you were a 4-star restaurant. You become a 4-star restaurant where you were a 2-star restaurant. And it's not like Nobody thinks of it as a subjective judgment, which is essentially what it is, but they think of it as like, so, you know, a $1 bill or a $5 bill.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's an objective reality, but the stars, to me, are not. The stars are, again, totally subjective, and, you know, one tries, one aspires to just think about it as it's just press, all press is good,
mm-hmm.
but it's a little hard.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think one of the things that we're seeing more of is we're seeing the chef's ability to tell, or the owner's, restaurant owner's ability to tell their story. And sort of media is diluting, and not diluting, but diluting. And, you know, with the rising importance of various things like Zagat.com, restaurant surveys, you know, blogs are becoming increasingly important.
Or sometimes restaurant owners get their own radio show.
Yeah, that's true. We get to have a little voice on that, too. And I think that's a good thing. And one of the things you're seeing more of is books like the one you've just written, because this isn't just a cookbook. It's a cookbook, and it's your telling your own story. And I think that's a powerful thing that chefs didn't always get to do.
Well, that's very much what I wanted to do. I didn't want it to just be a recipe book. You know, I wanted it to have a point of view, and I really kind of wanted it to without, without being too serious, too kind of self-important, you know, to kind of tell the story of, you know, how we got to where we are and why we're doing, why we do what we do, and, you know, who we are. And, you know, I really do, I think of our restaurant and really any restaurant as, you know, as a collaboration between a lot of different people, and, you know, people come and go over the years, and each person contributes what they contribute, you know, so we've been very, very fortunate to have important people especially stay with us for very long periods of time. You know, I think, you know, the sort of, for a lot of restaurants, the sort of standard cook, you know, spends a year and goes, but, you know, I've had blind cooks that have stayed for 10 years.
Why do you think they do that?
One waiter that's been with me almost since the beginning.
What do you think you do differently that keeps people that long?
I think it's the style of, I guess, for, you know, for want of a better word, management. But it's just the feel of the place.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very laid back place to work. You know, and it's very, you know, my wife and I are here. And it's very much ours. It's very much a projection of who we are, you know, quirky in some ways, idiosyncratic, whatever word you want to use. And I think it feels very much like a welcoming, family-ish place. And I think we want to make it feel, to some degree, feel that way to our clients as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't talk about service before when we were talking about things that I feel like we kind of were in the forefront of. But, you know, when we started, service was, in fancy restaurants, was very regimented. You know, there were, and in many restaurants still there, you know, there's layers of, you know, it's like a military operation. You know, there's your captain and your maitre d' and people, bussers and runners and so on and so forth. And we've never had any of that. We've always had a wait staff who can do and are expected to do all of those things. Take orders, explain the menu, talk about the wine, bus the table.
So how does the new person get to learn all those things in short order?
Generally we hire people that have had some experience and we train them. You know, they go through a period of, you know, following other people around and, you know, kind of gradually work their way into it.
And, of course, they have to learn the Chanterelle handwriting.
Yeah.
Now, your menus are still handwritten? The handwriting in which the Chanterelle menus are written is this wonderful signature, unique handwriting. And was that originally just Karen's writing?
It still is, yeah.
Does she do all the writing herself?
Mm-hmm.
What if she breaks her arm?
I'm sorry?
What if she breaks her arm? Do you have somebody else? Do you have an understudy?
I don't know what we're going to do.
She's not allowed to go.
Hopefully that won't happen.
She's not allowed to go skiing.
No, no skiing.
Okay.
You can break her leg.
But not her arm.
Just no fingers. You can even break an arm, no fingers.
Now, let's talk about what you selected to put in the book, because I looked through the book, and it's a this is a wonderful crossover book in another way. It can be a coffee table book, because it's a very pretty book, and I think a lot of books written by great chefs today do wind up on the coffee table and rarely make it all the way into the kitchen to get, you know, grease stained. This is an excellent recipe book that's very useful, and these dishes are...
Well, that's precisely why everyone should buy two copies.
I like that thinking. But, this book, the things in here are really executable by the home cook without too much difficulty. I mean, it's going to take some care. This isn't, you know, great meals in 30 minutes. But by the same token, the pictures are really important so you can see what the presentation is all about. How did you select what went in here, and what did you select that you may serve in the restaurant that didn't make it into the book?
Well, I have a sort of a repertoire. We change the menu now every 4 weeks, and we try to change it pretty much completely every 4 weeks. So, you know, there's sort of a repertoire of dishes, and I kind of looked through that and tried to, you know, kind of to some degree pick out, you know, Chanterelle's greatest hits. Things that I think are very representative and things that I know people like, and things also that are, you know, you don't want to, chefs tend to use the same, they have favorite ingredients and they have favorite proteins or whatever. There are certain fish that one likes to use or cuts of meat or whatever. You know, I didn't want to have 10 recipes for rack of lamb, even though I really like rack of lamb. I wanted to have some different lamb recipes. So you have to try to balance it. It's almost like trying to balance a menu. You might have the idea that you want certain things on, but then when you look at the menu and you write it down, you see that it's skewed all in one direction, and you want people to have choices, and you want to have something that, in a book, you want to show, you know, the range of things that you do.
And balance.
So there are things that aren't in there that I love because, you know, I kind of figure large quantities of white truffle are probably not in the average home cook's budget.
Right,
I'm not
right.
Even sure they're in my budget these days. But, you know, and I do tons of things with foie gras, but I thought I'd pick out a few. You know, so that's how we decided. And in terms of the sort of difficulty of the recipes, I mean, that's my cooking. You know, my cooking is not... There might be a fair number of steps, and you might have to start something one day and finish it the next. And it does presuppose that you are going to make stock because, you know, I didn't want to, you know, have that sort of cop-out, you can use, you know, low-sodium canned chicken broth if you want because...
That's a shortcut that just doesn't work out.
You can't.
Yeah. You can if you want it to taste good.
There is a reason that every great chef in the world makes their own stock.
Well, if you're going to cook in a sort of a French style, I mean, if I had to say what defines French cooking, it's essentially stocks and, you know, the reduction and infusing of flavors into stocks and that sort of magical thing that happens when flavors come together.
Well, now I'm curious about another issue in putting a book together. So, you know, you've been around for 30 years. Did you have all of these recipes written out, completely formatted somewhere in a recipe box in the kitchen, in a database in the kitchen that you would go back to? Or when it came time to write the book, was there a lot of stuff that was in your head and in your chef de cuisine's head that had to be put to paper for the first time?
Oh, absolutely everything. I mean, I don't have any recipes. The only recipes that I have are for things, I mean, my pastry chef has lots of recipes, and they're, you know, for things where proportions are really important at the very beginning, which are, you know, things where, you know, you make I like to make these sort of, I call them flans, these vegetable custards, essentially, as garnishes or parts of appetizers. And, you know, you have to have the proportions correct because you're going to mix it together and you're going to put it in the oven and you can't fix it.
And if the chemistry's wrong on those things, they just simply don't work.
But everything else that you cook in the kitchen, you taste it and you adjust it. So my recipe is, I'll tell my sous chef, you know that duck that we made 2 menus ago? Well, I want to do something like that, but I want to make it a little bit spicy, and so I think you should put some chilies in it. And, you know, that's a recipe. So everything, and besides which, the exact way that I would do things for the restaurant is not the exact way that the recipes are in the book, because the recipes in the book are for 4 people. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to make as much as possible, let's say, the sauce kind of organically sort of grow out of prepping the meat. So if I were cooking at home, that's how I would cook. So everything had to be tested. I had to make everything several times in that kind of quantity, in that kind of way, and write it down. And that was the hard part. That was the really hard part.
Well, the food
is not fun.
Well, the food is beautiful, the book is beautiful, and your restaurant is tremendous. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
David Waltuck's book is Chanterelle, The Story and Recipes of a Restaurant Classic. Chanterelle is located in Tribeca in Manhattan. You can find both links on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. And stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTCAM.com and restaurantguysradio.com.
Hey, Francis, what's your first choice of hotel in New Jersey?
Easy question, Mark. It's the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center.
You stay there because it's so convenient, right across the street from the restaurants, right?
I stay there because it's awesome. The rooms are elegant and stylish and comfortable. The service is slick and professional and kind. Did you know they have a swimming pool and a full-service spa? You can get a foot massage.
You know you're a decadent guy, right?
I do, and that's why I stay at the Heldrich.
Well, I stay there for more practical reasons. It's right in the heart of New Brunswick, so you can walk to all the great restaurants and brew pubs and cafes and three world-class theaters. You can even catch the train to Manhattan and be there in less than an hour. And if you want to dine or have a drink in the hotel, Christopher's Restaurant and Bar is right there.
The Heldrich is also great for business. In our dining rooms, we meet a ton of people who book corporate events, meetings, and conferences there, and they're all happy. With 248 rooms, 14 suites, and over 25,000 square feet of state-of-the-art meeting and conference space, the Heldrich can do up to 450 for meetings, social events, and even great weddings.
On the practical side again, it's only 25 minutes from Newark Airport. There's a direct train from New Brunswick and frequent shuttles. How easy is that?
To plan a meeting or book a leisurely getaway, call the Heldrich at 866-609-4700. Visit theheldrich.com or click through the link on our website, ask for the Restaurant Guys promo, or online enter promo code Catherine to get a special rate just for our listeners. That's 866-609-4700, theheldrich.com, or click the link on Restaurant Guys Radio. The promo code is Catherine.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, David Waltuck. I'm looking at this book right now. It's beautiful. It's really beautiful.
It's great. I also have in front of me that book we were talking about earlier, Staff Meals,
uh-huh.
which is the first book he did back in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking with David about staff meals early in the show, and we moved on to the other topics. But one of those things that I think really gets overlooked in a lot of restaurants is the family meal. And the family meal, people don't realize, certainly people in restaurants don't realize how well they can make things go or how they can drive a wedge directly through your front of house and back of house staff. If the back of house is not taking care to make something really good and really tasty and something that will last a waiter for 8 or 10 hours during their shift, that can really create ill will. And if the front of house isn't appreciative of the efforts that the back of house is making in order to create that, it can also create ill will. So in some cases, if you're going to make bad food for your staff meals or you're going to use leftover scrap, basically garbage, and serve it to your staff, I think you're better off not serving a meal at all.
Well, you know, it's funny. I worked in a townhouse pub. It was one of my first bartending jobs. And what they did, you know, in this little pub environment was you could order, mm-hmm. except for the lobster and the steak, you
yep.
could order off the menu.
I worked at a seafood place that
and
was
you know
basically
what?
The same
and
thing. And you got a discount. And
well, no, you were allowed to order one thing
oh, okay.
for dinner at this place, and that was your family
meal. You
know
the place I worked at? You were allowed to order anything off the children's menu. Isn't that awesome?
That's funny. Well, you know what? What is unfortunate about that is I realize if you work 5 days a week at the townhouse pub and you get to order off the menu, your choice is burger and fry, fried burger, fry, fried thing, more
fried
fried,
steak.
Fried chicken, fried chicken, fried,
some,
fried.
Some fried cauliflower.
Refried,
you can
fried
that
stuff.
That was the health food.
And, you know, if you eat that 5 nights a week for dinner, you're going to be an unhealthy and probably an unhappy person mm-hmm. over time. And what we try and do is we try to always have a salad. and we don't always do as good a job as we should, and we should
I
probably
totally
dedicate ourselves.
I would love to
compared
be
to places that I've worked, I'd like to brain my staff whenever they complain, because I remember we used to get served like the spent vegetables that had flavored the soup. They'd scoop them out, where in most restaurants they'd throw it away. The restaurant I worked in, they used to put that over rice and give that to us. I'm like,
awful.
There's no flavor, there's no nutrients. But, you know, this idea of having everyone sit down and having a meal together and providing them with a healthy and nutritious meal, I think it's a great morale builder. I think corporations and other...
It can be. Like I said, it can be. But if there's no care put into that... It's almost a slap in the face.
I think, and in, you know, corporations could do this, other businesses could do this, and I think would benefit from it. And it does show caring. You know, it reminds me, my father was a fireman, retired as fire chief. And the firemen used to get together and have a meal.
And they still do.
But do you know what was interesting? Is firemen worked 12 and 14-hour shifts back then. Our people, our front end back of the house, but especially our front of house people, they get to work at 4 in the afternoon. If they don't work a double, if they work
right, you could work lunch. You could get there at 10:30, maybe get a half an hour, 45 minutes in between shifts if things are crazy. Maybe it's not as much as you'd like it to be.
And that's when you get to eat. So it's not like a normal job where you go out to lunch and then you take a coffee break and then you take another break. You know, restaurant people get to work.
Or even take 5 minutes to go answer the phone.
Or get something out of the vending machine.
Exactly.
There is no vending machine and there's no going outside. So that meal can be really important, and a meal is, you know, we serve people food all night. Why shouldn't we come together and
enjoy
it?
We talk about
together?
The importance of people coming together and having food together. It's important when we do it, too. It's not just important for the people we're serving.
All this talk is making me hungry. We got to go. Hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I know we certainly have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.